Saturday, January 29th, last of my 3 days in New York. I spent the morning with Candy Ono, trying to turn my lovely Eastern fabrics, gifts of Madame Xiong, Ayub Khan, and others, into alluring at-home costumes. Susan Shine and her mother came by to see Linda. And then at noon, we left for lunch with Jean Vanderbilt. The names of the people I'm seeing on this trip are rather like those on the doors outside the boxes of the Golden Horseshoe in the old opera house. It was an absolute jewel of an apartment, very small indeed, its main living room not as big as mine at 30th Place, but exquisitely done, with chintz and books and flowers and a fireplace, and opening onto a terrace that overlooked New York. Besides Bess and Linda, her guests were the Edward Warburgs. He's a big Democrat, and she surprisingly has a Texas background. And Freddie Brisson, who's the producer of the current play Generation, and Rosalind Russell's husband. And Mr. Price Jones, who writes book reviews. An attractive, slight young Britisher, who's over here on an exchange scholarship. I suppose the date of our own charming Heidi. Long-haired, bright-eyed, fresh, whose education at 18 is simply fitted around her career on the stage. I felt completely alien from and completely charmed by the company. When we went in to lunch, I was between Truman Capote and Alan J. Lerner. With that curious alchemy of image, a reputation, he's almost become a legend among a certain type of people. So I was very interested to meet Truman Capote. Quite small, slight, unimpressive, with a speech impediment that shocked me at first, and then I completely forgot, because his conversation was so interesting. About other voices, other rooms. He'd written it at 19, he said, and then in cold blood. He described his style somehow, the change in it, as what happens to rocks when water flows over and over and over them for years and years, and they get smoother and smoother. And about Harper Lee, he was the little boy who came to visit in the summers in To Kill a Mockingbird. And Alan J. Lerner, on my other side, who did My Fair Lady. And it's likely to run for as long as 16 years in London, he says. So used to the British to going to see over and over plays that they like. And in a town of 6,000, after a play has finished its run there, it can count an attendance of 8,000. How many people must have seen it twice? Or from where did they come? At any rate, they're much more play-minded than in our country. It turns out that on a clear day you can see forever. There's no reference to eyes or to view, but to seeing with the mind down the generations of time. It was a thoroughly delightful luncheon. Most delicious food, triumph from decoration, in a little cubicle of a room that must not have been more than 12 foot square. A fat guest would never have fitted in. Mr. Lerner took us to the theater, and it was an enchanted 2.5 hours. The first act, I was caught up in the sheer web of humor and fantasy, all about the transmigration of the soul of an elegant lady of 1794 into the body of a blonde, gum-chewing, good-hearted, zany girl of 1966. Peopled with psychiatrists, young men looking for jobs and counting only the fringe benefits, beautiful choreography. And then between acts, we went for Danish pastry in the manager's office and coffee. And then back in the second act, there was, for me at least, a sudden, unaccountable break of mood. Somehow, the magic didn't click. I found myself thinking, transmigration nuts. But there was one hilarious scene in which a wealthy Greek shipbuilder, stocky in a striped shirt and a loud tie and a loud voice, came in to hire the psychiatrist, figure out who he would be in the next life. If I can't take it with me, I'm going to come back and get it. Somewhere along the line, I found myself caught up in the fragile web once more, and from then on, it was delicious entertainment. It must have been an exceedingly hard play to write and to carry. There'd been a lot of people wanting autographs, and clapping and standing up when I came in and out, so that I felt rather on stage myself and not relaxed. And then afterwards, we went back to meet all the actors. There was so much I wanted to say to them. The main actress had the most mobile face I've ever seen. It was a triumph, her change from the elegant lady of 1794 to the good-hearted and rather plaintive little soul of 1966. I was unhappily tongue-tied and couldn't really tell them all how much I'd enjoyed it. There were lots of pictures all around. And then Alan Lerner took us out to the car. We were off to the railroad station, dropping the Vanderbilts at their apartment. A real storm had set in during the day, and it was going to be impossible to fly. We were taking the 6 o'clock train. My first train trip, I believe, since the Lady Bird special in October of 64. The 3.5 hours lengthened and lengthened as the train went slower and slower. There was a snowplow in front of us from Baltimore on, and 3 changes of engines. We would be the last train in that night, I heard later. But with that one most valuable possession in life in my hand, time, I did nothing really constructive with it. Read Business Week and Look, and then a book of stories by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Best, talked to Linda Bird all the things she'd never had time to tell me about her trip to Acapulco. Good, but the fleeting moments could have borne more golden fruit. And then finally, in the unreal world of a heavy storm, we were in the Union Station at about 12. We had to walk past 11 cars. That was good, because the stinging cold air and the snow sifting into our faces made us all feel brisk and alive again. Then I looked on my right. There was a freight car with a door open and lights inside. I could see 3 oblong boxes, 7 or so feet long. On top of one, there were sprays of flowers, rather wilted gladioli. I suppose our destination was Arlington. It was hard to think of anything else. We rode home through a fairyland of silent snow. All the cars parked on the street looked like they would be there until next spring. You could see only the vague outline under the snow. And then at home, Lennon was in bed. He'd had guests, they'd just gone. And Linda and I cuddled up on the bed and told him about our trip. And he teased us and sounded happy.